Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 29th of April, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, we're going to get started today with a mainstream article, Patrick, because we were somewhat surprised, perhaps, that the mainstream was prepared to put this type of article in. Very little investigative journalism going on these days, but this is a pretty heavy headline.
This is an exclusive by the Mirror. Now, this has been reported in different forms, Mike, most recently in February as well. You've probably seen bits and pieces of this story. The headline reads, almost 50,000 animals killed during military testing at the secret UK research base. Of course, the secret base in question is Porton Down Biological Research Facility, Mike. And so what have they found? And essentially what we're looking at here, scientists have blown up pigs, infected monkeys with biological weapons, and poisoned guinea pigs with nerve gas. Now, remember the guinea pigs. We'll get back to that in a minute. But just moving on, we're going to summarize what's been found in this particular story, Mike. And it's a bit, if you're feeling squeamish regarding animals, you probably are going to want to look away at this point. But 50,000 animals have been killed between 2010 and 2017. Mind you, that's about an average of 20 animals per day for seven straight years. So they're very busy doing what? Well, to deliberately expose live animals to compounds, simulated blasts, biological pathogens, which are known and indeed developed to cause extreme suffering and death. Guinea pigs have had VX nerve agents applied. And just to see how they react and so forth, and bio scavenger, it's called, and to check the alteration of the biological functions of these animals and so forth as a result of these things like anthrax, mustard gas, and other deadly chemical weapons. This is all going on at Porton Down apparently every day. So what else has happened? The beasts were shot in different parts of their body with various rifles. And so army medics fought then to keep them alive. So apparently this has a military training aspect to it. And the MOD defends all of this, saying that it's claiming that it provides doctors with vital training, which has helped to save lives of British troops injured in battle. But also the pigs were also killed in explosive tests to test and to get more effective body armor. For British troops serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, just what are your thoughts on this, Mike? Just off the top of your head,
where do I start? I mean, is this really what Britain stands for?
Well, let's move on. Let's see. I'm just going to just remind people. In addition to the 50,000 animals, you can add a cat to that as well, as many people would have noted last year. Sergei Skripal's cat was put down, apparently because it was in an agitated state, according to authorities, and was taken to Porton Down and, I guess, put down and incinerated. Sergei Skripal's cat, there she is with Yulia. Of course, this is an article, one of the great journalistic scoops by Luke Harding, the Guardian's chief fabricator over there in Islington. And there's the guinea pigs over on the side, and a spokesperson from the... from DEFRA, Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs, said that the dead guinea pigs and a distressed cat were discovered when a vet was able to enter the Skripal's home, which was sealed off during the police investigation and so forth. So the guinea pigs were, you know, died just because the flat was sealed off for so long. The cat was still alive. Of course, Mike, none of these were, well, we don't know if the guinea pigs were exposed to Novichok. We don't know. It hasn't said that they were, so we're going to assume they weren't. This is the Novichok that was applied to the door handle. It's apparently in the magic gel form, mm-hmm. with the magic gel with the delayed reaction of the 4-hour delayed reaction magic gel that was developed in a secret lab somewhere in Russia.
Yes.
This was the magic Novichok compound. So, but why is this also interesting? Because speaking of dead animals, this was just Deborah Haynes.
Just a week or so ago, images supplied by UK government of hospitalised children and dead ducks affected by Novichok attack on Skripals were used by CIA's Gina Haspel to persuade rail Donald Trump to overcome skepticism and expel 60 Russian diplomats from the U.S. So, of course, this was some fake intelligence pumped in Donald Trump's direction to try to get him to act in a particular way, which he did. But the question is whether the images, Patrick, that of these dead ducks, were these escape ducks from Portendown?
This is a good question, and yet you're probably wondering out there, where are you going with this line of inquiry? Well, what we're showing is that there's a lot of theater going on outside of Portendown, but there's a lot of action going on in Portendown with real biological agents, including Novichok.
So can you explain to me, Patrick, if we are not developing weapons, chemical weapons and so on, if we have an OPCW, which is there to prevent the spread of chemical weapons use worldwide, and if we have agreements to destroy chemical weapons worldwide, why do we need to be killing so many animals?
Well, that's a good question. In case the bad guys, we're told this, in case the bad guys have these weapons, that we're able to sort of better deal with them and also to have the cures on hand as well, developing the inoculations to help people recover or cure from these deadly compounds, Mike. That's the official sort of line on biological and chemical weapons research.
Okay, well, I'm afraid I don't buy it, because if there is no new chemical weapons development and research, because it's embargoed globally, we have an OPCW there to prevent future development, then we don't need to do any further development work on protecting ourselves from these things, because it's all been done in the past.
Well, they were told we have to remain vigilant. So, in other words, we're talking about the theater, Mike. So just to remind people of the theater, this was just last year with regards to the Skripal incident. We remember this scene here. This is the man in the hazmat suits in Salisbury, and this was just a kind of a farce. As you can see, there's a fireman standing right behind them with no protection whatsoever. So this was completely for the cameras. So the Washington Post headline is interesting, saying that the U.S. and Europe say the Kremlin poisoned Sergei Skripal and the Russians don't buy it. Well, looking at that photo, Mike,
it's no wonder, really, is it?
No wonder the Russians don't buy it. It was all theater.
Just before the weekend, the second Belt and Road Forum took place. So let's get on to some more interesting stuff. Xi Jinping, obviously sitting there, he was leading it, of course. Vladimir Putin attended as well. Many other world leaders attended, including Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer. We'll come on to that a little later. But what was Putin saying at this? Quite important. He said, China is a vast country. Therefore, of course, China has plans for its development, and they're immense and ambitious. And one of the themes that we've seen over the last period of months and last couple of years, Patrick, is the clear concern that the West has about the Belt and Road Initiative and the development which China is doing. Certain countries absolutely on board with this. Britain saying it's on board with this, but as we'll see later, perhaps Britain speaking with a forked tongue. But other countries like the United States, for example, up until now, not on board with this. Trump is giving some indications that he would like to be, but of course he's living in a swamp, which he hasn't successfully drained yet, of a deep state which absolutely does not want to be. But anyway, Putin went on to say this. He said that, so how would China respond when it faces certain restriction and attempts by some countries to stop this development? What should China do? Well, that's a good question. What should China do? China, some people, if it was the West, was experiencing the type of pressure that China's experiencing at the minute, the West would start ramping up its military capabilities, start spending money on arms and armaments and so on. But the point that Putin is making here is that China is, in fact, implementing this in a civilized and delicate way, making sure proposals for common development meet the interests of the vast majority of international participants, if not all. Generally speaking, China has offered nothing new. What it's doing is really making attempts to reaffirm the principles set out by the World Trade Organization and so on. But he said, that China is, in fact, working on this development program primarily this is how it started, but it later became obvious, both in terms of China's growth and for us as well, that the concept of the Belt and Road Initiative would not be enough. We needed to strengthen the fundamental tenets of international economic relations. Is Russia interested in this? Of course it is, considering the high volume of trade and the fact that it's growing. And we're certainly interested in benefiting from the transit potential of the Trans-Siberian Railway and so on. But he's talking about the development of ports and all this kind of stuff. It's all quite positive. There's not really talking about regime change, for example. It's all very optimistic. And even in the Chinese press, we're seeing more of these types of articles. This is from CGTN saying Belt and Road fast lanes open at Chinese major ports. And what they're saying is that anybody trading with China on the basis of the Belt and Road Initiative will be fast-tracked through six land ports, 12 airports, in order to get their goods through a lot quicker and with a lot less bureaucracy involved. So the message from China absolutely was that they want to continue this process. They want to deal with any corruption that's creeping into the process. They're using some language like being encouraged to get involved with sustainable development and with the Belt and Road, and also the use of the green word, which of course is very popular at the moment. Mm. I'm not certain that they're terribly bought into these ideologies that the United Nations and Western system is pushing forward, but they do seem to want to draw people into the Belt and Road using that language.
Yeah, and again, talking about the ports you just mentioned, one of the deep water port locations, of course, is Sri Lanka. And as if by magic, there was a major terrorist attack there last week. And another important Belt and Road juncture is Myanmar, and has also experienced this upsurge in Islamic extremism via the Rohingya minorities settled in Myanmar, but also in the Xinjiang province in western China as well. So it's rather interesting, Mike, that in all the key nodes along the Belt and Road, you find ISIS popping up kind of randomly in these convenient places.
This is a very good point. And of course, we know that the Sahel group of countries along the southern borders of the Sahara Desert and right across that middle section of Africa is one of the key areas that China is helping develop through the Belt and Road Initiative. It's also one of the key areas in the world that also has an Islamic insurgency problem and a migration problem. So these can't be coincidences.
Well, the last thing I'll say about this is to look at the Belt and Road Initiative in terms of a globalization framework. If you look at the current phase of globalization, which many people will argue is at its tail end, I'm talking about the post-World War II U.S.-led liberal world order. So that globalization is a U.S.-led globalization. Think of the Belt and Road Initiative as the next phase of globalization, with China leading that phase of globalization. Okay, so now who would have a problem with this? This is the question you have to ask yourself. Whose grand strategy does this kind of interrupt or get in the way of, let's say, the project for a new American century, for instance, domination for the next 100 years? Of course, the United States, from a grand strategic perspective, might have a problem with China leading the next phase of globalization, with Europe in tow behind China as its major partner there, Trans-Asian. So that's the important thing I think that people need to just remember when looking at Belt and Road. Think of it as globalization with China leading.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to this. Now, it's slightly related, as you will see in a second. This is the House of Lords report, UK Foreign Policy in a Shifting World Order. And this was published in December 2018. Now, I just want to, there's an update to this, but before we come on to that, I just want to remind people what was said in this. They said, following a year-long inquiry, the House of Lords International Relations Committee published a report on new conditions now fundamentally changing international relations and their implications for UK foreign policy. They said, we've lived through a tide of worldwide disruption and change, trends including populism, identity politics, nationalism, isolationism, protectionism, and mass movements of people are putting considerable pressure on states and traditional structures of government. It's quite interesting they don't mention Belt and Road in this. But anyway, we move on. We've sought not only to look at needed responses, but to understand from our many witnesses and the roots of this upheaval in world affairs. Explanations are many, but it's clear to us that one powerful common influence fueling many aspects of change is the massive and ongoing revolution in communications technology, connecting and empowering people's interests, causes, groups on a scale never before known. So they talk about increasing volatility of international relations. They talk about the UK's bedrock relationship with the US. They talk about China's economic and geopolitical influence, although not mentioning Belt and Road specifically. And they talk about the Russian provocations. They talk about the UK resisting US challenges to the multilateral system. We need to get behind the United Nations, NATO, Bretton Woods institutions, World Trade Organization. They talk about renewed efforts to engage, for example, with the modern Commonwealth Network. And they say that new technologies, particularly relatively low-cost cyber capabilities, have created an asymmetric shift in the balance of security considerations. They're saying that global Britain, the branding of global Britain, needs more definition. We need to reverse cuts to Foreign and Commonwealth Office budget. Okay, well, that was in December. And then a week or two ago, the government published its response to this report. And so I thought we should go through a few of the key points here. They say the government agrees with the committee's assessment on China. So if we talk about China for a second, the UK has a strong relationship with China that supports economic growth and addresses global challenges. Equally, we have strong partnerships with other countries. The UK pursues an all of Asia approach, ensuring that we're active and present partner across the region. Well, Philip Hammond, as I say, was speaking at the Belt and Road Forum at the weekend. He said that it's clear that to support the sheer scale of the Belt and Road vision, private finance will need to play an ever greater role in these infrastructure projects. And to unlock that private finance and reassure investors, we must create a recognised infrastructure asset class for Belt and Road projects. And this has been sort of my concern for quite some time, Patrick, that in fact what Britain's approach to this has been is purely a City of London approach, in fact, and they want to pump new forms of asset class financial instruments into this project. This project is a physical development project. It's about developing real physical trading routes and you know, production of goods and moving goods around the world. It is globalization of a kind. I don't think it's quite the same kind of globalization as maybe we've seen in the last 40 years, which is increasingly moving towards services globalization, whereas China's still focusing on physical production of goods. But nonetheless, we see this intervention from Hammond, who's talking about really City of London financial products.
Let's be specific. What financial products do you think he's talking about? It looks to me like infrastructure bonds,
right?
Maybe as an investment opportunity for sort of ground floor investors in the city. That's what it looks like to me, and I see potential there for some sort of, you know, financial fiduciary malfeasance. On a big scale, perhaps.
There's no corruption in the City of London, Patrick. You must be mistaken.
Of course, their motives are whiter than the driven snow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's come back onto this then. Now, as far as Russia is concerned, we agree with the committee's assessment of Russia's global aims. The Russian government uses a range of powers to pursue its policies, including espionage, cyber and subversion, and persistently uses disinformation as a tool to destabilize its perceived enemies.
The US and Britain don't do any of that, do they?
No, none of that at all.
They've never done any of that.
No. So let's go on. The UK is investing approximately £100 million over the 5 years through our counter-disinformation and media development programme to counter Russian disinformation internationally.
So that's basically propaganda, censorship and troll farms.
Correct.
Basically.
So, sorry, what did we just say a second ago? Russia's pursuing a disinformation program, but we now have enough. How much money is Russia spending on their alleged disinformation program? Do we know?
I don't know, but
I don't think it's £100 million.
I don't think so. No, I think, but according to the UK government and the US, everything that comes out of Russia as a country is Kremlin propaganda.
Right.
Every channel, every bit of print, anything that's not pro-US Basically, it's not Radio Europe or, you know, the Moscow Times. It's all Kremlin propaganda. So it must be Russian disinformation.
Absolutely. So. But it doesn't end there. Let's go on. What have we got? A recent internal survey also concluded social media is an essential tool of ambassadors. So we're talking about Foreign Office here. They obviously have ambassadors, but they're suddenly realizing that social media is important. This came out of a question or a point that the report said that digital tools such as social media necessitate a constant upgrading of the techniques of diplomacy well beyond traditional skills. So they're now going to fully integrate social media within the Foreign Office's public diplomacy. So what does that equal? Propaganda?
Yes, that's propaganda. That's basically, yeah. It's what they're trying to do is leverage the power of social media. They're trying to sort of harness the power of Trump on Twitter and sort of show that in a sort of smaller sense with ambassadors and civil servants and things like that. What do you think they'll be tweeting? What do they be posting? Just messaging, right? Whatever the government messaging is. So that's propaganda.
Right.
Basically. So.
Okay. Now we're going to shift gears slightly, continuing this theme. The government agrees that the United Nations should engage with a range of stakeholders, including NGOs, business, and the private sector in its work. Now, this is an ongoing theme, the use of NGOs. And what is the role of NGOs in our governance? It seems to be in the last 20 years, NGOs have ended up having a pretty key role within our governance, and I think it's something that a lot of people don't quite grasp. Now, last night, Patrick, on the Sunday Wire, we were talking about Extinction Rebellion and Greta there and so on, and you had Corey Morningstar on as a guest. Fantastic segment, and if I do recommend anybody goes and listens to that on 21stCenturyWire.com. But we were talking about, on this program, talking about Corey Morningstar's article on the issue of Extinction Rebellion and NGOs, and a very big feature of that on Friday's news program, if you want to look at that as well. I just wanted to highlight this article on the UK Column website, Abusing the System Through NGOs and CSOs. Now, this was published in June 2010. It was written by Marietta Abels, and she gave us permission to publish this. And it's a fascinating article because she's talking about this whole green agenda that we're seeing. So this was published 9 years ago, Patrick. She made the point in this article that President Clinton had issued Executive Order 12986, which granted NGOs, in this case the World Wildlife Fund, certain diplomatic privileges and immunities. So already in 2009, which is the period of time that she's talking about here, an NGO, the World Wildlife Fund, had been given diplomatic privileges and immunities by the United States government. And they also got a lot of income. So the World Wildlife Fund's reported 1995 income in the United States, this is just for the United States, was $138 million. And assets of $62.5 million. And then that went on. So she listed here 2003, they received $370 million. 2004, $468 million. 2005, $499 million. 2006, $549 million. This is just for the United States. And in 2007, it was $663 million. So $2.5 billion over those few years. You know, you've got to ask the question, why is so much money going into these NGOs who are supposed to be providing a humanitarian, in some cases, or a charitable service? But in this case, with the likes of the World Wildlife Fund and these types of NGOs, very much a political agenda at work there.
Yeah, it's not just a political agenda, Mike. And I think the Indian author and activist, Arundhati Roy, who wrote the Booker, I believe she was the Booker Prize winner with The God of Small Things. The novel was published in the 90s. So she basically described this as the not-for-profit industrial complex. Okay, and Corey Morningstar, who you mentioned earlier, who was on the Sunday Wire last night, that's the sort of focus of her work. But the NGOs are there, essentially, were created initially by the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Carnegies, And this was under the sort of the banner of civil society that was a sort of emerging out of the first industrial revolution, early 20th century, Mike. And so what were they doing? They were kind of moving in to sort of fill what appeared to be the gaps of inequity. But what they did is get the oligarchs in a position where they could dictate public policy via the NGOs. And there's a great quote here, and also to hijack real political movements, to basically to mute, to co-opt people power, to sort of dial it down so that there's no real political radical, let's say, revolutionary movements coming up. This was a way to tame them. That's what essentially the NGOs are used around the world. A great quote here by Arundhati Roy, she says, "How do you vacuum up people's fury and redirect it down a blind alley?" And if you understand that quote, that really kind of encapsulates the not-for-profit industrial complex today in 2020.
But in fact, from based on what you've just said and what we know, that doesn't even go far enough, because it's not redirecting it down a blind alley. It's actually redirecting it along the lines that the corporate or the government interest wants the policy to go in. And so you know, the people who are protesting last week under the name of Extinction Rebellion individually have an idea of where they want corporations and governments to go. But in fact, the fact that they've protested in that way through that NGO and through other NGOs, they end up actually promoting the policies that they probably hate in the first place.
That's true. That's true. So believing they're part of a grassroots organization or grassroots movement, when in fact they're laying down astroturf, essentially. But yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Well, look, on the same subject, I just want to highlight this article from Tim Hayward, "Trees Don't Grow on Money," or "Why You Don't Get to Rebel Against Extinction." And he's making many of these same points, again, highlighting Corey Morningstar's work. And I just want to recommend that people read that.
Yeah, that's a great article by Tim Hayward. He's also drawing a lot of criticism from people. Corey is as well, from the George Monbiots of the world.
Yes.
He's sort of the green gatekeepers, if you will, of the establishment. But just back to the show we had last night, I do encourage people to listen to what we did. We broke down what is the Green New Deal. So if you don't understand essentially what's the concept behind, you hear this term a lot with AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the United States, and it's a real popular buzz term right now with Extinction Rebellion, Greta Thunberg, the Green New Deal, or the New Green Deal, depending on who's using this term. They've rearranged that a few different ways. What is it? What is it essentially? Well, we kind of broke it down in the show last night, and it's essentially what we're looking at here. If you want to just get the basic principles of it, the financialization and commodification of nature, what does that mean? That means putting a value on every single blade of grass, every tree, every acre of land, every bit of the sort of the ecological portfolio, as they call it, and sort of commodifying it and then putting a cost on it, and then sort of balancing this off in a new financial paradigm, a new sort of accounting system for the globe, if you will. You can imagine who's very interested in this, Mike. The big investment banks, central banks, are interested in it. So what's the principle behind this? How are they going to fund this? Well, they have a spokesperson, a figurehead, one of them, at least the one today, one of the main ones is Greta Thunberg. It's a teenager from Sweden. She's in fact backed by a multi-million-dollar corporate PR and communications machine, and Greenpeace as well. I believe she's being managed at the moment by the CEO of Greenpeace, who's her sort of chief handler at the moment. So her whole story was meant to appear to be grassroots, when in fact it was anything but. It was very, very carefully choreographed with a lot of very powerful players behind her, including a PR firm, a tech firm in Sweden called We Don't Have Time. So essentially this is a new shell game, the New Green Deal, carbon offsets, carbon taxes, net zero emissions. You'll see this term a lot. What does that mean? That doesn't mean zero emissions. That means net zero emissions. That means net zero on paper. It means that you can emit all you want so long as you buy the certificates for carbon offsets or pay your indulgence tax by whatever planting supposed trees in somewhere in India or something like this, or in Africa. So net zero does not mean zero emissions. This is part of the scam of the Green New Deal. So a new green rating system. Imagine a TripAdvisor for people, for companies, for politicians to name and shame, or to heap adulation and five-star ratings on good green people. So don't think this is going to stop everybody with businesses and politicians. This is going to be extended most likely to everybody, every single organization, every school. Total mayhem potentially here if this is allowed to sort of get a foothold. So this is by the Swedish firm. We don't have time, okay? So these are essentially the people behind this are in financial communications, essentially. So that's what you need to know there. And finally, to fund the new Green Deal, where's the money going to come from? Well, they're talking about it. Mike's already reported on this in the UK column last week. Raiding the global pension funds, $100 trillion. They want to, quote, unlock the pension funds. So you can see the generational war by using children in a demagoguery type fashion. And the target is the pension funds of the old people. And so you already have the kind of war between the generations. They're using these children as these figureheads. We'll talk about this more during the extra time segment, Mike, after the show. But so it's this is the kind of the look on this. Is you can see the marketing here, the Green New Deal. It's all very kind of Silicon Valley type marketing. Amnesty International, Benetton, the same sort of thing. There's Greta and all these great green thinkers here. What else is there? Well, this is a good place where people should start. This is Corey Morningstar. This is her blog, The Wrong Kind of Green. This is a six-part series, or six acts, as she's laid it out, basically explaining all of this. Who are the players? What is the sort of the structure? Who are the financial interests, the corporate interests behind all this? This is all explained by Corey Morningstar on her blog, The Wrong Kind of Green. If you're out there, I encourage people to go start reading this. It's very long, very detailed. But if you really want to know how this is put together, this is the first place to start. Yeah. So I encourage people to do that. So the climate crisis, what else is going on with the climate crisis? This is an interesting story. I just thought I'd flag up as the end of this segment, Mike, to close it out. But the Rockefeller Foundation is winding down its biggest private climate resilience push. So resilient cities had 100 resilient cities. It's winding it down. This is very interesting. What is going on here? We thought the resilient cities would be going right into the next century. No. Why have they wound it down? Well, according to the Rockefeller Foundation, they're ending funding and dismissing staff on the 100 Resilient Cities program. And so this was the largest privately funded climate adaptation initiative in the United States. And they wanted to shift their funding to where? This is interesting, Mike, to the Atlantic Council. They're going to parlay $30 million grant to the Atlantic Council. Now, who are the Atlantic Council? This is a NATO-aligned think tank. They're also running censorship protocols for social media like Facebook and Twitter. So they're involved in the censoring of the internet. They're also involved in propaganda. And the Atlantic Council and the DFR labs are also involved in running defamation campaigns against alternative media persons. So they're now been given $30 million from the Rockefeller Foundation. So this is interesting, to allow to continue to support the transition of the 100 resilient cities. Very interesting. So this, according to this, the Atlantic Council will be putting new structures in place. And so this is kind of winding down the whole cities thing. They said that they've met their goals, basically, the 100 cities, Mike. So now they're sort of they've adapted to the threats related to climate change. So but now the Atlantic Council is taking over. This is interesting. So look at how well positioned the Atlantic Council is. They're sort of in Silicon Valley. They're in government. They're in the military. And so they're sort of involved now in managing climate change. Very interesting. And again, where's the funding coming from?
The big foundations.
Foundations. Yes. So very interesting.
Okay. Well, sort of related to Patrick.
Well, a lot of people might have picked up this story over the weekend. This is the 5G story of the week. Glastonbury Festival is going to do a test run of 5G, basically put all of its 200,000 festival entrants and staff and performers in what some people are calling the biggest microwave oven in the world. And this is a really significant story. If you're a 5G campaigner, this is actually a great thing. Because look who is running this story. This is a major music magazine.
Yes.
So right now, that means the sort of the hip, the millennials are going to be hip to 5G. They're already calling it, in this article, military weapons-grade frequency. Now, this is something that campaigners have been warning about for a long time. The mainstream media has been very slow to the punch on this story because of the commercial implications. A lot of the big carrier networks have invested, or EE, for instance, is well invested into the 5G network, so as not to hurt business. I'm sure the media have been a bit cautious about sort of talking
about it. Less than cautious. They're promoting it as hard as they possibly can at the moment.
They're promoting it. Now, the young and hip crew know about it,
right.
Okay? So this is going to be going on social media. So what you can expect right now, Mike, is a counter-disinformation campaign. When you see the word counter-disinformation, that means propaganda, okay? So you're going to see a counter-disinformation campaign coming from the 5G industry, coming from government saying, hey, it's okay. And anybody saying that it's not okay is a conspiracy theorist. So that's the only play I think they have.
Well, I'll tell you, the first play they're playing it right now because they're starting to market products as 5G already. But, of course, it's not 5G. It's kind of 4.5G, you might say. It's basically 4G technology, which is ramped up slightly, so it's not full 5G. Now, they're going to label stuff as 5G, which isn't 5G. They're going to start pushing it out almost immediately. And then they're going to say, no, this is just a normal evolution from 4G. Nothing to worry about here. It's not weapons-grade frequencies or weapons-based frequencies at all. It's just a natural evolution of 4G. We're starting to see this being pushed out by the industry already.
Well, just to go back to the Glastonbury, sorry, if you find that for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, look at this for a minute. Just
keep talking, Patrick.
Yeah, just to quickly ask yourself, why would festival goers require 5G mast to be installed around a festival site? This is the question. And apparently the answer to this is in order to give festival goers and ticket holders and so forth faster download speeds.
Yeah.
And also upload speeds. Why would you, if you're going to a festival to see live events, like one of the few times you can actually see something live the whole year, why on earth would you want to be potentially cooked in this environment for what? Fast download speeds? Look at the image here. This is, you're supposed to be at a festival having fun, meeting people, and having a few ciders and whatnot, rolling around in the mud, not on your smartphone. So this really is indicative of where this generation's values are. Are people willing to sacrifice their health and well-being for faster download speeds?
Yes.
This is the fundamental question, Mike.
Absolutely.
So I think people should pay attention to that.
Okay. A quick advertisement, Patrick.
Yes. There's an event that's going to be held in London. This is Wednesday, May 1st, Bloomsbury Baptist Church, Central London, Holborn, and Covent Garden Tube Stations. Imperialism on Trial, Free Julian Assange. Great lineup of speakers, of course, and seeing this is the one and the only George Galloway, but you've also got Craig Murray, Annie Michon, Emily Butlin, and Alexander Mercurius from the Duran, who we met a few weeks ago, and also Peter Ford and others. I'll also be giving a brief address at that event as well. It's only £6 online, and probably on the door maybe £5 or something like that, but do check this out if you're in London or in the vicinity of it. Very important event. This is about the Julian Assange trial. This is one of the most important defining moments in press freedom history. His situation is perilous at the moment. So the more support there's going to be, the better. And also this is right the day before his hearing with regards to the U.S. extradition, Mike. So that's going to be, there's a protest organized outside the Royal Courts of Justice, I think the following day on Wednesday. So if you want to get any information, just go out social media on Facebook, Imperialism on Trial, Freedom Stop War. You get some more information on this, and I hope to see you there.
Okay. Now, over the last few months, of course, anti-Semitism has been a major issue brought up in the mainstream press. Well, it seems like Islamophobia is the next one. So this is a report come out via Policy Exchange, written by Richard Walton and Tom Wilson. And they're really discussing this, the all-party parliamentary group, there's a typo there, apologies for that, on British Muslims' definition of Islamophobia, which says Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. Now, Richard Walton has many problems with this. Now, he's formerly police. And he's saying that what worries me now is that the police, the intelligence agencies and ministers should soon have their hands tied if the government chooses to officially adopt this definition. This asserts that Islamophobia is rooted in racism. It's my firm view that this is a deeply flawed definition which wrongly conflates the religion of Islam with a racial group, and that over time that could cripple the UK's successful counter-terrorism strategy and counter-terrorism operations. Now, these are his words. I'm not suggesting that their counter-terrorism strategy is successful. He says that there are two kinds of legal challenges that we could see if the definition was made available, which could hamper counter-terrorism efforts. The first would be a judicial review of operational decisions by police, their counterparts in other agencies, and by ministers dealing with terrorism threats. And the second would be challenges under the Human Rights Act, and the right not to be discriminated against by public authorities. And just think, how could the police or anyone else disprove that they had targeted or an expression of perceived Muslimness? So many people may feel that he has a point, but the question is what is going to be the reaction to this if it is pushed out? Do you think that people that are on the in the alt-right or on the right wing of politics may be emboldened by this, because here's a definition which is protecting their arch enemy, which is Islam, and therefore they're going to react to that in some way. Well, I just want to put that out there and then highlight this little statement that was on the BBC Radio 4 Today programme this morning.
Research has shown that between 2009 and 2018, 73% of extremist attacks in the US were domestic terrorist or extremist attacks. So there really has been a disproportionate focus on Islamist terrorism and Islamist extremism. We haven't seen from either the private sector or government a proportional response to this rising threat of far-right extremism that targets Muslims, targets Jews, targets women.
So there's a number of points there, Patrick. This rise of far-right extremism, which targets Muslims, targets Jews, and targets women. Now, I wasn't aware that women were the target of the right wing, but there you go. Apparently they are. But it seems to me that if the all-parliamentary party, the all-party parliamentary group pushes this definition of Islam, if it's getting this type of pushback, and if the government accepts that, then that is going to have an effect on the groups that are perceived to be right-wing groups. They're going to react to that, and perhaps that helps to bolster this narrative of the rise of right-wing extremism in this country and in the United States. And I think that that's a pretty dangerous position to be taking us into.
Well, I mean, I just want to comment on something that the criticism of this, Mike, when they're talking about, which in my firm view, this is a deeply flawed definition which wrongly conflates the religion of Islam with a racial group. So, but the same critique could be applied to Jewish and anti-Semitism. Because there's this ongoing debate: is Jewish a race or is it a religion? Has it been conflated, and what sort of confusion can result from that? This is exactly what's coming out of this debate right here. I think that's rather ironic, rather ironic, but also fascinating, Mike. So what I'm going to predict, Mike, is they can't do much about this, because if they tackle this issue based on the criticism which you've just outlined, by this this gentleman here, then they're going to have to apply the same methodology to the anti-Semitism issue and to sort of Jewish identity as well as Muslims. So
this could be opening a can of worms.
It could be opening a big can of worms. So I think that's actually fascinating.
Okay, well, just very briefly, because we're out of time, I just want to mention Brexit, of course, because it's ongoing. Well, we have a quote from Jeremy Corbyn here. It's not really a quote from Jeremy Corbyn. It would be a quote from Jeremy Corbyn if we'd spoken to him, but I'm quite sure. Because the first thing he says is he's meeting Theresa May again today because there's more meetings between Labour and Conservatives to try to pull together this government of national unity that they're trying to build at the moment to push her deal through. But he says he doesn't hold out much hope. She won't shift her red lines. I suspect she's holding out for a second referendum. European parliamentary elections. And this is the key point, I think, because this seems to be the direction the government is going, that the European parliamentary elections, which Theresa May absolutely says she does not want to hold and she wants to get her deal through before May the 22nd so that we don't have to hold European parliamentary elections. It's clear that all the parties are preparing for those elections. She intends to hold those elections. Because that would be a proxy second referendum. Now, I don't know what results she's expecting to get from that. The Tory party themselves saying that they possibly could lose as many as 800 council seats in the local elections. There's clearly a bit of a backlash against them, but they're taking this risk anyway. Jeremy Corbyn actually meeting his MPs, his parliamentary party, later on today, to decide what the Labour Party position on a proper second referendum is going to be. So some few issues, Brexit-related issues going on at the moment, but really, I don't think there's any real likelihood of Theresa May's deal going through before the 22nd of May, so we are going to be facing European elections, and it is going to be a proxy second referendum.
And then what's going to happen after that? Is that going to up the ante, as it were, for a actual second referendum?
Well, that depends on the result. Depends on the result.
How is it looking so far?
This is very hard to know. There is a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that, in fact, the result is going to be much harder in the direction of Brexit than it was in 2016.
Anecdotal evidence.
It's hard to know because, of course, the polls, do we trust the polls? No, we don't.
No, because if you trusted the mainstream polls before the first referendum, you would have gotten wrong on all your bets.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. Okay, we will leave it there for today because we're absolutely out of time. Thank you very much for joining me today, Patrick. Thank you for joining us. Of course, we just end by mentioning Robert Greene, whose funeral is taking place today. Most of the UK column people at that. Our thoughts with them for today. And we will be back on Wednesday at the same time, 1 p.m. We will see you then. Bye-bye.